First Kings chapter 1. Excuse me. First Kings chapter 1. For the sake of those who will be watching this video in weeks and months to come, this is the post-election Sunday message. This is being preached on the Sunday after the 2016 elections, after Donald Trump became the president-elect. And I'm going to give Micah a good heads up on this one. This title is How to Deal with a Conspiracy. How to Deal with a Conspiracy. I am absolutely convinced that this message must be preached on this Sunday. That the principles that we are going to discuss in the Word of God are absolutely relevant to everything that is happening in our country today. And I believe you're going to agree with that whenever we go through this. I'm going to start reading in verse 5. Then Adonijah, the son of Haggith, exalted himself, saying, I will be king. And he prepared him chariots and horsemen and 50 men to run before him. God had already determined, and David the king, who was now an old man and literally on his deathbed, had decreed that it would be Solomon, David's son, the son of Bathsheba, who would be the next king of Israel. Adonijah was not to be king. Adonijah was David's fourth son, and the oldest son that was yet living. Therefore, Adonijah was Solomon's half-brother. Same father, different mother. Adonijah was deliberately trying to take advantage of an old, sick, and dying man, his father, David. Adonijah knew that Solomon had been chosen by God to be king of Israel. He knew that David had already decreed that Solomon, son of Bathsheba, was to be king of Israel. But David was probably paralytic. He was bedridden, sick, and dying. Adonijah schemed that he would circumvent the selection of Solomon to be the king of Israel, that he would appoint himself king, and he would steal the throne from his half-brother Solomon. Now, before I go any further in this address, I have to make mention of something that is paramountly important and very relevant to this particular story, which begins in chapter 1 and then continues into chapter 2, which I won't get into for sake of time, but really the story of Adonijah and his rebellion against Solomon and against David, and his attempt to steal the throne really continues from chapter 1 and into chapter 2, and I'll just mention it briefly when I get toward the end. But I have to mention this because of the reality of the situation as it relates to this story. The polygamy practiced by many Old Testament men, including David, always, without exception, always led to great evil. You cannot find an example where even the greatest of Old Testament men did not pay a terrible price when they violated God's law for the family and committed polygamy. Monogamy was sanctioned by God in the Garden of Eden. When God created the family, He created one man and one woman. He did not create one man and a bunch of women. He intended that men and women live together in a monogamous marriage. Polygamy was something that the heathen nations surrounding Israel at that time, in fact, still do in that part of the world, committed polygamy. It was a pagan practice. It was never the intent of God that His people practice polygamy. And each time one of these men did, it cost them dearly. And we are still living with the consequences of some of the polygamous acts that were committed by some of these Old Testament men, even in our day. David is probably the supreme example of a man who paid the worst possible price for the practice of polygamy. This story that we are reading about Adonijah would never have taken place had David been faithful to the monogamous standard of the family that God instituted in the beginning of time. Here he is on his deathbed. Think about it. He's sick. He's old. He's dying. And he is still paying the price for his polygamy. It's a serious sin with serious consequences. And David is a classic example. He's being cursed up until the very last moments of his life with the results of his unfaithfulness to a monogamous marriage. At 70 years of age, David was sick and decrepit. There was a lot of men in the Old Testament, and I'm not talking about the unusual men before the flood who lived up into the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, but there were many other men that lived long past 70 and enjoyed very good health long past 70. At the age of 70, David was sick and dying and decrepit, bedridden. He had to be fed in bed. He had to have 24-hour-a-day attention. He was totally dependent on someone else just to maintain a daily life. There's obviously several reasons for this. It started whenever Saul declared David to be his enemy, number one, and hunted him in the woods like an animal, tried to kill him. The stress and the toll that it took on David as a young man because of Saul's hatred and violence against him no doubt took a toll. He was a man of war. He was a warrior. They sang the song, "Saul hath slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands." David was a professional soldier. Really, he was the consummate soldier. He was a man that knew for the most part, nothing but war. He was a battlefield commander. He was not a man that led his troops from the soft cushion behind the battle scene, but he was a man that led the army out front and took his own sword to the enemy. He was a mighty warrior. But think about the toll that that took over time. We are not told how many times he was wounded. We are not told how many times he was cut, how many times he was hit with blunt objects, how many times he had bones broken. We don't really know. The Bible doesn't go into any of those kind of details about his battlefield experiences. We know that he won the battles. We know that God gave him victory. We know that he lived through the battles. But we have no idea what he went through on the battlefield. We have no idea how many times he was hurt. We have no idea how many times he was wounded. The wars that he was involved in all of his life surely took a heavy toll on his body. The many betrayals that he endured from friends. Adonijah was not the first son to try and steal his kingdom. If you remember, his son Absalom, years before, had done the same thing. When David was still in the prime of his reign, Absalom stole the hearts of many of the men of Israel against David. And he created a coup against the throne of David. His insurrection was so successful that David had to flee the palace and flee the city for his life because of Absalom's army that had temporarily taken over the city of Jerusalem. He had to again, the second time now, after all those years of being chased by Saul, now he was chased by his own son, Absalom, like a dog in the woods all over again. He was much older now, still a fighting man, still very much a man of wisdom and knowledge and so forth as far as his kingly ability was concerned. But still, there he's going through it all over again. But this time, it was not his best friend like it was with King Saul. That was bad enough. But it was his son, Absalom. And after Absalom was finally killed in battle, after David had commanded that he not be killed, but he was killed nonetheless by the evil general Joab, and we're going to get to him in a minute. You remember in the picture, and if you can in your mind see this, David now returns to the palace. The insurrection has been beaten back. David's mighty men have once again saved his life and saved his kingdom, those 300 men or so, and then those 30 captains that never left his side, that always were faithful to him and fought for him and risked their lives for him. And some of them died for him. And once again, they were the ones that rallied to his side, and they defeated Absalom and the rebellion. And now here's David, an older, tired, weary, almost broken man who's just lost his most handsome, most intelligent, most favored son, if you could even say that at that time, Absalom. And you can see him, the Bible tells the story of how he crawls up the steps going into the throne, crawls up the steps on his hands and knees, tears coursing down his face, and he cries out, "Oh, Absalom, Absalom, my son, my son, my son, Absalom, my son, would God I had died for thee." That took a toll on David. And yes, the family upheavals, the many, many family upheavals that he is responsible for. You remember the story with Ammon, and the story with Tamar, and the story with Absalom, and you remember all of that, where you have one brother killing another brother, and you have one brother, these are all half-brothers and sisters, and one brother raping another sister, and think of the trauma mentally, emotionally, think of the physical drain that had taken a toll on David's life. Some of it, of course, David had no control over it. Others of it, David did have control over it. Nevertheless, here he is, 70 years of age, not that old, comparatively speaking. 70 years of age. And he's a decrepit, sick, dying man. And again, his son, Adonijah, is trying to insurrect against his father's kingdom and steal the throne from Solomon on his deathbed. He had no peace except for the peace that he had in Jehovah God. Verse 6. And his father had not displeased him at any time in saying, "Why hast thou done so?" And he also was a very goodly man, and his mother bare him after Absalom. Here is another major weakness in the life of David. And David is my hero in the Old Testament. But we have to be honest and acknowledge the sins of David. David, as great a king as he was, and as great a warrior and soldier as he was, and though he was the man after God's own heart, the man who wrote most of the book of Psalms, the man who is called in the New Testament the man after God's own heart, David was a terrible father. His polygamous relationships with women compromised his father image and his father responsibilities. In verse 6, his father David had not displeased him, Adonijah, at any time. Why hast thou done so? David never corrected Adonijah. He never disciplined him. He never applied his dutiful discipline as a father, and that was a habit of his throughout his life. He was a very weak disciplinarian who allowed his children, especially his sons, to grow up pretty much always getting their way. Adonijah is just another Absalom. David didn't discipline Absalom. David didn't discipline Adonijah. These boys grew up without the strong disciplining arm of a father, and it came back to bite David. And it will come back to bite any parent who will not properly discipline his or her children. Proverbs 29:15. The rod and reproof give wisdom, but a child left to himself bringeth his mother, and I will add his father, to shame. You leave your child undisciplined, and that child is going to bring you shame when that child gets old. David, as great a man as he was a very weak father. And Adonijah is the result of that weakness. Verse 7. And he conferred with Joab, there's Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and with Abiathar the priest, and they following Adonijah helped him. Notice the treacherous threesome. Adonijah, Joab, who was the commanding general of David's army, and Abiathar the high priest. It seems that treachery often appears in threes. The evil trinity in Revelation is a threesome: Satan, the Antichrist, and the false prophet. Simon Peter denied Christ. How many times? Three. Satan tempted Jesus. How many times? Three. It seems that treachery comes in threes quite often. The treachery against me in Florida was led by three. The treachery against us here at Liberty Fellowship not long ago was led by three. And here is that hellish threesome in this story of 1 Kings. Abiathar the high priest, Joab the commanding general of the army, and Adonijah, David's son. The three that led the conspiracy against David, against Israel, and against Solomon, and ultimately against God Almighty. Because any time you conspire against the leaders that God has established, you are ultimately conspiring against God Himself. This conspiracy ultimately was not against Solomon and David as much as it was against the Lord God Almighty. Verse 8. But Zadok the priest, and Benaiah the son of Jehoiada, and Nathan the prophet — that's the same prophet that said to him after his sin with Uriah and Bathsheba, "Thou art the man." If I was going to create a second list of great men of the Old Testament, Nathan would probably be on that list. Nathan the prophet, Shimei and Rei, and the mighty men which belonged to David were not with Adonijah. Thank God for faithful men and women. Let me hear it. For faithful men and women. Zadok the priest didn't go along with it. And Benaiah, he was another general in the army, didn't go along with it. Nathan the prophet didn't go along with this conspiracy. And David's mighty men did not go along with this. Again, those mighty men show up. Verse 9. Oh, by the way, Shimei and Rei may have been David's brothers. There are many Bible teachers that believe that these were David's brothers, his blood brothers, that were also very faithful and loyal to David here at the very end of his life. And Adonijah slew sheep and oxen and fat cattle by the stone of Zoheleth, which is by Engrogel, and called all his brethren and the king's sons and the men of Judah and the king's servants, all these people he called to this party. But Nathan the prophet, Benaiah, and the mighty men, and Solomon his brother, he called not. Adonijah attempted to circumvent the lawful reign of Solomon before Solomon was inaugurated and before Solomon took reign. Ladies and gentlemen, we are witnessing the attempted coup of the American nation from socialists, globalists, and other anti-America, if I be so bold to say, individuals and groups who were trying to thwart the lawful election of Donald Trump as president. Not only are they rioting in the street, please understand that not all of these rioters are just spontaneous hotheads. Some of these rioters are being paid by George Soros and others of his ilk to create a climate of fear in the American public so as to undo what a lawful election has done. These people have no interest in the rule of law, no interest in the Constitution, no interest in the principles of good government. They are all about forcing their socialist agenda upon the rest of the country. Now we are hearing talk in the media. And by the way, just like you should not have been listening to the media before the election, I suggest you should not be listening to the media after the election. Because all they do, is twist and spin. Let me ask you, how many have ever heard after a president-elect was elected, the media talk about the possibility of the Electoral College not voting for the duly elected president and on their own giving the election to the individual that didn't win? They have never said that. They have never suggested that. And yet, every day, there's some part of the media that's suggesting, and there is like 3 million or 4 million people that have signed a petition calling for the electors on December 17, when they actually go into the Electoral College and officially vote Donald Trump as president, to deny their oath and to deny their constitutional responsibility and the fidelity to their state that voted for the candidate, whichever candidate it was, and to, on their own, give the election to Hillary Clinton. Now, I want to say this right here. First of all, that has never, ever happened one time in the history of this great republic. Never. One time. Those electors swear an oath to support the election of their state and to cast their electoral votes according to the states that sent them to the Congress, the Electoral College, not Congress, Electoral College, and to be faithful to those voters of their states who elected whoever it was in that state, in this case, the majority going by over 300 electoral votes to Donald Trump. We, the freedom-loving, if you want to say conservative, I don't really like that paradigm, liberal conservative, but just for the sake of discussion, because that's how people categorize us. Freedom-loving, conservative, constitutionalist, law-abiding people, we did not march in the streets, we did not riot in the streets, and we did not threaten the Electoral College when Bill Clinton and Barack Obama were elected presidents in this country. But I want to tell you, I want to tell you, by God, we will not tolerate a bunch of radicals stealing the election from the man who won the election. If you want to awake a sleeping giant in this country, which I don't think is asleep anymore, I think it pretty much woke up last Tuesday. But if you really want to awaken, if you want to rile good, honest, hardworking, law-abiding people in this country, then you get those Electoral College members to go in and deny their oath and deny their state and deny the Constitution and then vote in Hillary Clinton as President of the United States. You haven't seen anything like what would happen if that happened. There is no way the people of this country would tolerate that. Not for any second would they tolerate that. And I find it absolutely ludicrous, insulting, and absurd that people who say they have an IQ that's higher than room temperature to try and circumvent a constitutionally elected president. To put it in perspective, that's what Adonijah and these men conspiring with him were trying to do. They were trying to steal the lawful appointment of King Solomon away from him. They were trying to circumvent the laws not only of Israel as a nation, but the laws of God. That's the kind of conspiracy that Adonijah was involved in, and that was the kind of conspiracy that these other two men, Joab the general and the high priest, were involved in. But did you notice in verse 10, the people that they did not invite to their party? They did not invite Nathan, the prophet. They did not invite Benaiah, the general. They did not invite any of the mighty men. They did not invite Solomon. Conspirators seem to instinctively know who not to invite to their parties. I heard some of you say, well, you know what? I know these people were going, you know, back yonder many, many months ago, and they were having their, you know, their meetings of discontent, and they were in their sessions of spiritual rebellion and so forth. But you know, Pastor Chuck, I didn't know anything about that. I was never invited. You ought to pat yourself on the back. They didn't invite you for a reason. They knew that you would rain on their parade. Can you imagine what would have happened if they would have invited some of David's mighty men to these planning parties of theirs? If they'd invited Benaiah? If they'd invited Nathan the prophet? Hey, don't feel bad. I wasn't invited to those parties either. Boy, this Bible sure is out of date, isn't it? I mean, there's just nothing relevant. Verse 11. Wherefore Nathan spake unto Bathsheba. I think Bathsheba was a great woman overall. I really do. And if I was making a list of great women in the Bible, I'd probably list Bathsheba. She endured a lot, and she I think, showed a lot of grace and character, and we see some of that here in chapter 1 and 2 of 1 Kings. In fact, her name appears more in chapter 1 and chapter 2 of 1 Kings than anywhere else in the Bible. Wherefore Nathan spake unto Bathsheba, the mother. Don't forget, Solomon wrote Proverbs 31 to his mother Bathsheba. Who can find a virtuous woman? For her price is far above rubies. He wrote that about Bathsheba, his mother. Nathan spake unto Bathsheba, the mother of Solomon, saying, hast thou not heard that Adonijah the son of Haggith doth reign, and David our Lord knoweth it not? Here is how to deal with a conspiracy. The first thing you have to do in order to deal with a conspiracy is you have to know that the conspiracy exists. David knoweth it not. This conspiracy would only be successful as long as the conspirators could keep it from David. David knoweth it not. I want to say this, and I have no idea whether Mr. Trump himself has ever listened to any of these messages or whether he has read any of my columns. I do know for a fact that there are people in his campaign that do watch these messages and do read my columns. And how far up the ladder that goes, I have no way of knowing. But here is what I want to say to Mr. Trump and to those who are close to him as he assumes office. Do you comprehend the conspiracy that you are up against? Do you understand the depth of this cabal? Do you understand the reach of this cabal? Do you truly understand that this is far more than ideology? This is far greater than left versus right, or conservative versus liberal, or Democrat versus Republican. This is far, far, far more than that. We are talking about a conspiracy that reaches all the way up to world power. We are talking about wealth that is immeasurable. We are talking about people in the Democrat Party. We are talking about people in the Republican Party. We are talking about people that call themselves liberal, and we're talking about people that call themselves conservative. We are talking about people from many nationalities, many ethnicities, many religions. We are talking about people who have an entrenched evil that is diabolically evil and wicked to its core, and to whom the ultimate objective of their cabal, actually probably plural, cabals, plural, is the destruction of the liberties of the United States of America and the destruction of our constitutional republican form of government. Do you understand the conspiracy you are up against? One sign that we should all be looking at very carefully, and we're going to start getting an indication of this within the next 2 weeks. We must be very, very watchful as to who Donald Trump appoints to his leadership in his administration. If Trump makes Newt Gingrich the head of a cabinet, or Rudy Giuliani, or Chris Christie, or Bolton, if men such as this are put in leadership positions. Now, if he wants to make any of these men an advisor, I don't have heartburn over that. Presidents have hundreds of advisors, and most of the advisors give advice, and the president says, "Thank you so much for your advice. I appreciate you." And then he walks out the door and does whatever he's going to do anyway. So advisory capacity is not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about Secretary of State. I'm talking about Secretary of Treasury. I'm talking about Secretary of Defense. I'm talking about the key positions of headship among the cabinet of his administration. There is none worse. These CFR globalist, there's none worse in the world than Newt Gingrich. None. If he puts Newt Gingrich in any major position, we should all be extremely concerned. If he makes Rudy Giuliani Attorney General, two things that signifies. Number one, it signifies that there's going to be a continued burgeoning police state in this country. Rudy Giuliani is Mr. Police State. There is no one that is more pro-police state in this country than Rudy Giuliani. Giving that man the position of Attorney General should send shivers up your spine. The second thing a Giuliani appointment to Attorney General would mean, that there would be no investigation and prosecution of Hillary Rodham Clinton and Bill Clinton and all the rest of those career criminals who should be investigated, who should be prosecuted, who should be put in prison. Mr. Trump said many times he was going to drain the swamp. Mr. Trump, with all due respect and with all sincerity of my heart, you cannot drain the swamp by bringing back and putting in power the same people that filled the swamp. This is going to be a very, very intricate part of Mr. Trump's administration. And it will give us all an early indication as to how, A, serious he is, and two, how knowledgeable he is about just who was it that filled the swamp. Who are the real enemies? We will see. Verse 12. Now therefore come, let me, I pray thee, give thee counsel. Nathan talking to Bathsheba. That thou mayest save thine own life and the life of thy son Solomon. Nathan was a wise man of God, a prophet of God, whom God showed things to. Nathan said to Bathsheba, you need to wake up to this. If Adonijah succeeds in his coup, you will die, and your son Solomon will die. Adonijah has murder in his heart. Now we read verses 13 through 21. Go and get thee unto King David, and say unto him, Didst thou not, my lord, O king, swear unto thine handmaid, saying, Assuredly Solomon thy son shall reign after me, and he shall sit upon my throne? Why then doth Adonijah reign? Behold, while thou yet talkest there with the king, I also will come in after thee and confirm thy words. These were people that David absolutely trusted, Bathsheba and Nathan. Bathsheba went into the king, into the chamber, and the king was very old. Abishag the Shunammite ministered unto the king. Again, Abishag was a part of that whole process that I talked about earlier that got David into all of this trouble. Nothing good came out of anything that has to do with all this polygamous activity in David's life. And anyway, Bathsheba bowed and did obeisance unto the king. And the king said, What wouldest thou? She said unto him, My lord, thou swearest by the Lord thy God unto thine handmaid, saying, Assuredly Solomon, thy son, shall reign after me, and he shall sit upon my throne. And now behold, Adonijah reigneth, and now, my lord, the king, thou knowest it not. And he hath slain oxen and fat cattle and sheep in abundance, and hath called all the sons of the king, and Abiathar the priest, and Joab the captain of the host. But Solomon thy servant he hath not called. And thou, my lord, O king, the eyes of all Israel all upon thee, that thou shouldest tell them who shall sit on the throne of my lord the king after him. Otherwise it shall come to pass when my lord the king shall sleep with his fathers that I and my son Solomon shall be counted offenders. You can't help but be impressed with the grace and the poise and the character of Bathsheba. She's quite a woman. The way she conducts herself in the presence of the king, her boldness to tell him the truth of what was going on, her charm and her dignity are very readily apparent as you read the language describing what took place here. Solomon was to be king by lawful decree and by God's anointing. We see that in verse 13 and we see that in verse 17. Even when at the time that Solomon was born, God told Nathan the prophet that he, Solomon, was God's favored one. He actually gave him another name, a name that God, if you want to say a God-given nickname to Solomon, which was Jedidiah. The word Jedidiah means beloved of the Lord. And God instructed Nathan to give that name to Solomon and to tell Bathsheba and David that Solomon was to be the next king of Israel, even from the time that Solomon was born. But I want you to notice in verse 20 the statement, the eyes of all Israel are upon thee. I submit that the eyes of the whole world are upon Donald Trump and the United States of America. Now that Mr. Trump is the president-elect, upon assuming office in January, he must do what he said he would do. Too often, presidential candidates have promised the American people many, many positive things, only after having taken the office to totally forget those promises. We have seen that over and over and over again. And quite honestly, I don't think the American people that elected Mr. Trump are prepared to put up with that anymore. I don't think they are. Here are the 16 things that Donald Trump needs to do upon assuming office. based upon his commitment to us, the people of the United States. Number one, he needs to enforce our immigration laws and protect our borders, as he said he would. Number two, he needs to cut off all financial aid to illegal aliens that are already living in the United States. And he must immediately deport criminal illegal aliens. He must press Congress to rescind that abominable Obamacare. He needs to put an end to our endless wars of aggression in the Middle East. He needs to leave Syria alone. It's none of our business. He needs to pull NATO back from encroaching on Russia's borders, waterways, and airspace. Better yet, pull the United States completely out of NATO and end all financial aid to NATO. Number six, he needs to order the CIA to stop financing and supporting the Muslim terror groups such as ISIS. Number seven, he should ask Congress for mark and reprisal authority to destroy ISIS once and for all. Number eight, he should press Congress to reduce taxes, spending, and regulation, and promise to veto any bill that doesn't do that. Number nine, he needs to press Congress to expunge, completely eliminate NAFTA. He needs to appoint a Supreme Court justice that supports the right to life, the right to keep and bear arms, and who also supports the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution. And that's the one I'm most concerned about. Number 11, he must press Congress to repeal, he talked about it on the campaign trail, he needs to do it, repeal the Johnson Amendment from the 501c3 tax code. If that happens, it would take away the tree that these pastors have been hiding behind since 1954. And if they are going to refuse to take a stand, if they continue to refuse to take a stand, then let everyone know it has nothing to do with the IRS tax code and it has everything to do with their own cowardice. You'll have no more excuse to not get in your pulpit and take a stand. You'll have no more excuse to not get in your pulpit and say anything you want that needs to be said, you feel that needs to be said to your people about anything that might be political, no matter what it is or isn't. You will have no excuse, except you're too cowardly to do it. I hope that happens. Number 12, he needs to sign an executive order repealing most of the executive orders written by Presidents Clinton, Bush, and Obama. Number 13, he needs to banish the globalists and the socialists from the U.S. government. Number 14, and he's talked about this, he needs to shut down the Departments of Education and Commerce, the EPA, OSHA, and the BLM. Shut them down. Too many people have been sucking off of the teat of the taxpayers for far too long. It's time they went out and got an honest job. Bureaucrats up and down the Beltway are scared silly. They're going to lose their jobs. We've been feeding the beast too long. The beast needs to go on a diet. Number 15, he needs to implement competitive tariffs. He's talked about this. Tariffs, duties, and imposts as to make it unprofitable for U.S. manufacturing companies to take their factories overseas and make it profitable for them to bring jobs back to the United States. And then number 16, and lastly, and I'm taking this from one of his debates, he needs to appoint a special prosecutor to investigate and prosecute Bill and Hillary Clinton along with all of their fellow conspirators. Everything I listed is pretty much in the mandate that elected him president. That's what the people of America were thinking about when they went to the polls and gave him the majority. Those were the issues on their hearts. Now, we need to pray for him and his family. I truly believe that Mr. Trump was an outsider. I do not believe he was controlled opposition or anything of that nature. I truly believe he was an independent-minded individual. But the fact that he was independent and not controlled by the cabal doesn't mean that after he's elected, he cannot become controlled by the cabal. We need to pray that if indeed he is the independent man that most people think he is, that he'll be able to maintain that independence after he is sworn into office. Again, the power of the cabal is very, very huge. I think, secondly, I truly believe the media, the pollsters, and the establishment itself knew that Hillary Clinton was going to win the election. They thought it was in the bag. Never in our history have we seen a major media do everything in its power to destroy the candidacy of a presidential candidate than the media did against Donald Trump. We've never seen it, anything like it. They truly thought she would win the election. And as the night went on, and then about halfway or a little bit more than that way through, when it became obvious that she was not going to win, there's no question in my mind that the establishment, for the most part, was not planning for that. Which means we need to pray very much for Donald Trump's safety. In my lifetime, this is my opinion, but in my lifetime, I believe there's only been two presidents before Donald Trump that were not controlled by the cabal. The first was John F. Kennedy, And the second was Ronald Reagan. We know what happened to John F. Kennedy, and we know what happened to Ronald Reagan. Ronald Reagan was shot 70 days after taking the oath of office. 70 days. If my analysis is accurate, that the cabal did not think that Trump would win, that they truly felt that Hillary was going to win and their plans were accordingly, and now that this has been a total surprise to them, you know that they are in the back rooms and have been ever since Tuesday night plotting and scheming as to what their next strategy and tactic will be. No, I don't think that. I hope that Mr. Trump and the key personnel around him truly understands the risk that he is living under every moment of his life. And we as Christians need to pray for him in that regard. And I would also like to caution and counsel Mr. Trump . Sir, you need the Lord on your side.
Amen.
And the first thing that God looks at in the life of a leader is a humility and a reverence and respect for God. If you will walk humbly before God and you will follow through with what you said you would do, it is God that protects you. It is God that's going to give you wisdom. It's going to God that's going to give you strength. It's God that is going to give you success. You need humility, sir. And you need to understand how much you need your Creator. I was saddened Tuesday night, actually early Wednesday morning, when Mr. Trump gave his victory speech. I wish he would have taken a moment during that period of time when he was thanking his family and people that supported him. I wish he had taken a moment to have thanked God for giving him that position of responsibility that he did. He said nothing about God in his victory acceptance, or not acceptance, but victory speech. And I hope and pray that does not portend a proud heart that doesn't recognize his need for God. And by the way, these 25 spiritual advisors that he has chosen, I hope at least one of them is telling him what I just said. How do you deal with a conspiracy? Because we have one going on right now in this country. Just as real as the conspiracy of Adonijah against David and Solomon. They're conspiring against the people of this country. They're conspiring against our Constitution, our rule of law. They're conspiring against the man that the people just elected. They're conspiring against the constitutional system of government itself. How do you deal with a conspiracy? Number one, one must be discerning enough to comprehend that it exists. You're dealing with a deep, dark, sinister, evil conspiracy, Mr. Trump. Please understand that. Secondly, one must be strong enough to banish betrayers and traitors from positions of trust and leadership or from the organization itself. You cannot give trusted positions of leadership to people that have betrayed you and the country and have been traitors to the Constitution and the principles of law. I didn't read it, verses 49 through 53. I was supposed to read those verses. Basically, what happened is whenever David found out about this conspiracy, he immediately installed Solomon as king. Before he died, he didn't wait for his death. He went ahead and immediately installed Solomon as king of Israel, which is absolutely what he had to do. Whenever the conspirators found out about that, they realized their conspiracy was known. They became afraid, of course. Adonijah appealed to Solomon for leniency. Solomon told him, "I will let you off. I will not harm you, but I'm also banishing you from my government." I pray Donald Trump does not bring back to the administration of this presidency these traitors who have been the source of our problem for so many decades. Solomon banished Adonijah from his kingdom, but he said, "Go home in peace." But he warned him, "If you ever try anything like this again, I will execute you." And guess what Adonijah did sometime later? He tried the same thing. He tried to use the Shunammite Abishag as his vehicle to insurrect against Solomon's throne. But he tried to do it again. And Solomon did what he said he would do. He executed the man. He would not have done that if Adonijah had kept his word and not tried to betray his kingdom again. So one must be strong enough to banish betrayers and traitors from positions of trust and leadership, or depending on the type of organization, from the organization itself. We cannot abide traitors among us. Thirdly, one must be wise enough to surround him or herself with right counselors. Fourthly, one must be principled enough to incorporate right principles and laws. And then fifthly, one must respect, reverence, acknowledge, and trust his or her creator. That is Mr. Trump's formula for success. And I pray he's up to the task. Because truly, the future of our country and of our world is hanging in the balance. That's how you deal with a conspiracy. Let's stand for prayer.